This is the Great Discontent Podcast. This conversation was recorded in front of a studio audience at the Wythe Hotel in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, as part of TGD Live, a monthly interview event series. Your lovely and well-dressed host for the night was Tina Essmaker. Enjoy the show.
Our first guest is an award-winning designer and educator who joined Pentagram's New York office as a partner in 2012. Originally from Taipei, Taiwan, she earned her BFA in graphic design from the School of Visual Arts. Known for her innovative use of graphic, verbal, digital, and spatial interventions that challenge conventional notions of media and cultural contexts, her work is immediately recognizable. Her projects span brand identity systems, packaging, exhibition design, digital interfaces, signage and wayfinding systems, and print and architecture. Guys, she's really done it all. She's a faculty member at the School of Visual Arts and a guest critic at Harvard, Yale, Cooper Union, RISD, and Maryland Institute College of Art. Please give a warm welcome to Natasha Jen. That was such an intro.
Hi. I wrote that.
You did a great... Did you do it to torture me?
As I was listening, I was like, I could edit this a little more.
We could do that.
Yeah.
I can help you.
Thank you.
Okay, cool. After the show. So I've actually been trying to interview you for a really long time, and I think I spammed your inbox at one point, but I might have guessed the wrong email. But I'm not going to say it, because then all these people are going to email you.
Oh, people can find out my email, like, instantaneously online. I'm getting so many just, like, strange emails, you know, from fan mails to, I don't know, collaboration opportunities to IT businesses trying to do business with Pentagram, but they somehow think I'm the person to contact, you know, all sorts of things. Yes.
Wow. Interesting.
Yeah.
Good thing your assistant goes through your email and you don't have to look at it. Right? So anyway, I've been trying to interview you for a long time, and coincidentally, we met over brunch during the summer. Mutual friend invited us to brunch, and now here we are. And so I'm really excited to ask you all of these questions. So I want to start where I like to start with everyone, which is the beginning. So you were born and raised in Taipei. So tell me a little bit about your childhood there and how it influenced your ideas about creativity.
I was born in a pretty liberal family, you know, typically in a Chinese tradition family, you would have a pretty kind of rigid path that is expected of you that you have to follow through. And certain ideas about careers, you know, are always like very deeply ingrained in early childhood. But I like to draw as a child. And in fact, I would just draw on any blank surface that was in front of me, including the walls in our house. So my parents kind of recognized that they got a daughter who is perhaps artistic. And my father really encouraged me to just pursue whatever I like, you know, without actually putting it into any kind of career path. And I think that was really, really important to who I am today, because I think that he instilled, you know, this idea that you can actually create and it's okay to actually do whatever you want to do. Yeah.
That's awesome. Were your parents in creative fields or?
No, my mom was a housemaker, you know, she was a great mom. In fact, she's here with us, not today, but she's living in New York right now. She's living with us. And my father was a businessman. He was, you know, he had his business. He was doing international trade. But he was very passionate about photography. He was really a kind of photo geek, you know. He would collect cameras, and he was always taking photos of us, you know. And at some point, when I first came to New York, after I dropped out from a fine art department, I actually considered getting into the photography department. And I took a class, and I actually did really well in that class. But then I was just so overwhelmed by the cost of photography equipment. And at that time, that was 98, you know, it was really the time before digital photography. So, you know, I chose graphic design instead.
Yeah, you mentioned switching your major. I wanted to ask about that because you came over to the U.S. in 98 to study at SVA, and you actually were going to study painting. And then in your freshman year, your dad passed away, and your mom encouraged you to do something that you could make a living mm-hmm. doing. I don't know why she thought you couldn't make a living painting, right?
It would probably be hard, you know. Yeah. As a money making fine artist, you know, that would have been hard, I think.
So you at that time when you switched your major to graphic design, is that something that had been on your radar before, or how did you land on that?
Oh my goodness, it was just such a desperate choice, you know. As I said, I knew that okay, I had to stop the dream of becoming a painter. So I was already at SVA, right? So you want to stick around, you know, you don't want to transfer to different schools. So I was looking at these different departments from illustration. Okay, so first of all, I was not a very good illustrator. Okay, I liked to draw as a kid, but more in a kind of doodling sense. You know, I knew that I didn't have the skill to become an illustrator. And then I was looking at computer art department, more in the area of animation and, you know, 3D design. And that felt really complicated to me. I think I'm kind of lazy by nature, you know. So anything that kind of it required deep learning on the surface tend to intimidate me. So I was really intimidated by that. And I looked into photography, figured out I couldn't afford it. All I had was graphic design. And I really had no idea what it was. You know, I was like, graphic. I mean, okay, I understood what design, you know, vaguely meant, but I didn't know what graphic design was actually about. And then, okay, I got a senior person who was actually in the fine art department. And he told me that, oh, you know, these are the programs that you have to learn, Photoshop, Illustrator. And he actually demonstrated how to do certain tricks, you know. And I was like, oh, I can probably learn how to do that. So I enrolled in graphic design. That's how I got to where I am here today.
So your whole career has been an accident.
Sort of.
Not the whole career, but the beginnings. So after school, so you stumbled into graphic design. I can do this. Great. You graduate. After school, you worked on fashion and brand identity projects at Base Design. You led large-scale branding exhibition and editorial projects at 2x4, and then you worked as a creative director at Stone Yamashita Partners. So you did some of that work, and then so I guess, you know, what were the first few years out of school like for you?
You know, I was already working as a student. I was interning in my second year. So right, I finished freshman year. That was in the fine art department. And I started graphic design in my second year. And I started an internship then. And I interned at that office. It's Eric Baker Studio. He's now, you know, not practicing the typical design service anymore. He's teaching most of the time, but I interned there for 2 years, and then I interned at Pentagram. So I was already working. I was very kind of career minded, you know. Despite that, I stumbled into graphic design. I think partially it was also because that I really wanted to stay here in New York. And I knew that in order for me, an immigrant, to stay here, I really had to get a job. You know, there was no other option. So I got a job even when I was in school. I got a job in the last semester of my fourth year from Sony Music. And getting an offer from a big corporation was actually a really exciting thing, you know. So I took the job right away without thinking too much about thinking, oh, you know, I would be designing CD covers. There were CDs at that time. Can you believe that? Like, we're actually designing CD covers. So I started working at Sony I think even before graduation, I was just like going on and on, you know, nonstop. And now looking back, I think that I could have probably relaxed a little more, you know, and that's the thing that I now tell my students is that, you know, really take some time to figure out, first of all, what you're interested in and figure out what you're good at and try to find a place that you admire and go for those, you know, choices. Don't feel that you have to rush yourself into a job right away, you know. I mean, if you have to pay the bill, do something, that's okay. But don't feel like you have to get into these positions, you know, per se right away.
Yeah, that's great advice. And sometimes what you're doing to pay the bills can be different from what you're doing to fulfill you, right? I mean, a lot of times those are different when you're first starting out.
Yeah, definitely. You know, I did a lot of random jobs before I went to college when I was in Taiwan. I spent 4 years just doing like literally random things, you know, from waiting tables to working in a department store, for example, to, I don't know, like riding a motorcycle, you know, selling CDs, you know. But then when I was in New York the first year, I also did, now, you know, looking back, random job. That was being a tour guide. Believe it or not, I was a tour guide for one summer. And that was the first summer I got to New York, and I didn't really know New York that well at all. You know what I mean? Like, so I went to Barnes and Noble's. Okay, I was told, okay, here's a route that the bus will take the tourists through. Okay, we're gonna check out these spots. All right, so I remember I went to Barnes & Noble on 14th Street, like, no, not 14th, 17th Street, Union Square, you know, still there, right? I remember that I got a book about New York City, and I just read through the book, paying attention to those, you know, destinations, and then I just started working, like, second day. So you just kind of wing it, yeah.
I did not find that when I was researching online to prepare for this. It's not online.
Oh, there are a lot of things that you don't know.
Mm. Yes. Now everyone's going to know.
Yeah, that's okay, right?
Yeah. So what was your top destination on the route?
Oh my goodness. I remember everybody liked the UN. They always feel that is a kind of very important place to be. People also liked Central Park. People liked Financial District, and they were always really impressed by the architecture there. I mean, I don't remember those dates and, you know, histories and stories that I had to remember about those places, but I really had to remember a lot of histories that I actually didn't have any interest in, you know, like dates, you know, when did the Dutch come to New York, and, you know, they actually got a whole New York with two turkeys, for example, stuff like that. So I had to really like memorize a lot of information pretty much in 24 hours. But but now, yeah, you know, like now, you know, every time I pass, if I actually happen to pass the UN, you know, I will always think about the time when we're, you know, like standing outside in front of the UN. You have to line up, you know, to get in. And I had to really figure out like what to say during the waiting time to you know, to entertain people. Yeah, those are fun memories.
Former life. So you worked for some other people. About 8 years post-college, you decided to start your own studio. How did you know it was time to do that? And was it a risk for you?
Well, it was time to do that because I didn't want to work at any other agencies anymore. And that was a pretty clear realization for me, having worked at three different studios, you know, going from graphic design studios to a strategy consultancy, which was entirely a different business, right? So also kind of understood how advertising agencies work, and having actually freelanced at a ad agency for several months, I just knew that I didn't want to actually get into working for a studio anymore. And I mean, to be frank, there wasn't any company in New York that I wanted to work for. So again, it was that kind of like out of no choice, right, situation. I just decided to start taking on projects on my own. And luckily, I had a couple of inquiries, you know, that just came in very naturally. So I started working pretty immediately, you know, with small identity projects. But that kept me busy. And then as my ambition kind of got a little bigger, I moved out of my own apartment. I was actually working in the apartment. I moved out from the apartment and rented a studio on 38th Street in the Garment District, sharing a studio with my friend who's an architect, and then got three more desks because I started to get, you know, more work, and I wanted to work with interns. So I started getting interns, and I started hating 38th Street. You know, that whole area just felt really kind of depressing to me. And I was like, well, I want to move to downtown. Therefore, I got a studio on Canal Street, and we moved to downtown. We had our own studio. And then I joined Pentagram. But, you know, during the time I was working on my own and moving studios, I was already in discussion with Pentagram, you know, but not really knowing what the outcome would be. So it was interesting that I kind of prepared myself for both scenarios. You know, one is that I would continue with my own practice, or I would join Pentagram at some time.
So I have two follow-up questions to that. One is, what do you wish you had known before you started your business? And then the second is, how did you know you wanted to leave this thing you had built and become a partner at Pentagram?
Good question. I just started, you know, doing my own business without actually really understanding that you can't get the design right until you figure out the people aspect of things, meaning that if you don't know your clients or whoever you're working with, you're working for thoroughly, you're not having a full control of what you're doing. And that was something that I didn't realize until you know, recent years. So, you know, I had pretty difficult time with a couple projects during that time. One was designing an identity for a pretty renowned school, architecture school. And the process was difficult, you know, but it wasn't because my design options were not good. They were really like thoughtful design, beautiful options. But then I realized that I actually didn't get the people aspect right, meaning that I really didn't know how they worked as an organization, how they talked to each other as a group, how decisions are made amongst themselves, who was actually making certain decisions. I didn't know any of that. And I didn't actually know that I had to know these things in order to make sure that, you know, our design can navigate through that. So that was the most important thing that I would just tell, you know, any designer, be someone who has been working in the field for years or be someone who just start out today. I think the most important thing is really about getting to know the people you're working with.
And how did you make the decision to join Pentagram? I mean, I know when Pentagram asks you to become a partner, you should probably just say yes, but
that was pretty much it.
Yeah, right. No, you're like, all right, well, I can't say no to this, you know. But you're one of the youngest partners to ever join.
I was.
Right? You don't have to reveal.
First of all, I'm no longer the youngest partner.
Ooh, okay. Who's the youngest now?
Either Jody or Luke in London, and okay. They're brothers. Yes, is one of them, 1 or 2 years younger than me. But when I was asked by Paula specifically. Over dinner, You know, I was, and imagine, just imagine that situation. This is not a meeting room kind of, you know, negotiation. You're actually at the dinner table with really dim light, with great food, with several glasses of wine already, and Paula Scher asked you to be her partner. Like, what would you say, right? You say, yes, wonderful, you know. But then I was really nervous, you know. I could feel that my blood was just like rushing up, right? You know, I feel that my heartbeat was going really fast. And then it was several months of questioning the pros and cons of this choice. Of course, I was incredibly flattered, you know, like never at any point in my life I would imagine that I would become a partner with this, you know, this really amazing group of designers. But then at the same time, I wasn't sure that as a designer, and also as a designer who's running a business, I was ready to embark on that kind of journey. So there was a lot of, you know, doubt about myself, I think mostly about this decision.
But you said yes anyway.
You just go do it. Yeah, and you go figure it out. You figure it out later.
That's
on.
Right.
Yes.
So you've talked a lot about this need for discovery and surprise, how a need for discovery and surprise underscore the work that you and your team do at Pentagram. That's a big part of your approach. So tell me a little bit more about what you mean by that.
It's really a kind of emotional need that I have to have as a, not only as a designer, but just as a person, is to actually be excited by the work that we produce. And I think that kind of feeling is really primitive, you know. It's non-intellectual, because you're not looking at anything and analyze it and ask yourself, do I like it or not? Am I feeling excited about this or not? It's not that kind of process. It's very quick. It's something that catches you right away. And it's very important for me, and I think now for my team, to actually have that kind of emotional reaction to our own work, you know. And I think that actually motivates a lot of the design decisions that we do. But also, you know, at the same time, we definitely consider our clients' context, you know. So we're not always just putting out, you know, say like fun stuff all the time, right? But it doesn't matter what the nature of the work is. We really have to feel excited by looking at our own work.
But how do you make space for surprise and discovery when there's so much pressure and you're working with these huge clients with big budgets, right? And you're like, oh, we're just going to have fun and see what happens. Is that...
What a timely and good question. We actually had a presentation today to a really big client. And today was the second round of identity design, okay, visual identity. And the client hated the first round, everything. And that rarely happened, really, you know. So and that first presentation was 3 weeks ago. So you can kind of imagine how nervous we have been in the last 3 weeks, because we had to get this round right, because if this round failed, we would probably just get fired, you know. But fortunately, this round went extremely well. You know, there were directions that really stood out. But I think that we've learned how to live with uncertainty. We've learned how to live with the anxiety of, you know, not knowing how people may react to certain things that we actually feel super excited about.
Look, you've likely heard of MailChimp, and there's a good reason why. More than 15 million people use MailChimp to connect with their customers, market their products, and grow their e-commerce businesses every day. But here's something you might not know. You can run Facebook ad campaigns right from MailChimp. Use the same simple design tools they give you for email to create great-looking ads. You can target ads at your audience or people similar to them, which is a great way to reach new customers. Track sales, customers, and subscribers all in one unified dashboard for both advertising and email. If you're looking to up your email game or try your hand at a Facebook ad campaign, MailChimp has the tools you need to grow your company in a way that feels right for you. We want to thank them for supporting the Great Discontent podcast. MailChimp. send better email, sell more stuff.
So I'm going to bring up our second guest, and I've got a fancy intro for her as well. Our second guest is a graphic designer, art director, and illustrator who creates holistic visual solutions for clients across disciplines. Passionate about finding the best tools to execute content-driven visuals, she brings identities to life through thoughtfully crafted print and digital implementations. Originally from Finland, she studied graphic design and illustration at the University of Art and Design Helsinki and the Rhode Island School of Design. She founded her New York-based studio in 2012. She's been nominated for Forbes magazine's annual 30 Under 30 list, the Art Directors Club Young Guns Award, and Print Magazine's New Visual Artist. And she has given talks at conferences and educational institutions across the U.S. and Europe. Please give a warm welcome to Lotta Nieminen. Did you write your bio too? And do we need to edit?
I just realized I just launched a new website.
Yes, I saw that.
Yeah,
congrats.
And that was part of it. And like a big girl, I started calling myself Studio Lotta Nieminen. Or is it Lotta Nieminen Studio? It could be either or.
Either.
That's how fresh it is. And I wrote a new bio to sound like a big girl, and it sounds pretty atrocious right now. But really, mostly it's just me. So a one-woman studio.
Well, and here you are. So I met you first in, I think, 2012. I interviewed you for thegreatdiscontent.com, and that was a Skype interview because I was living in Michigan at the time. And then we did this print issue, and we did a follow-up with you. And we did that interview in person over a couple margaritas.
It was happy hour, yeah.
It was happy hour, and I had the company card, and that
you it's told the best interview I've ever done, by the way.
She did tell me that before the show. I thought it was pretty good, and so here we are again. I'm excited to catch up on what you've been up to. I think that second interview was 2014, so it's been a few years.
Yeah, I think so, yeah. A couple years ago,
yeah,
for sure.
You've done a few things since then,
yes,
which we'll catch up on. But first,
yes.
I want to give people context for how you got to where you are. So you actually grew up in a home where creativity was expressed and encouraged. Your mom was a painter, dad is in music, and you were very rebellious.
Yes.
Because you wanted to do the opposite of your parents. And I have a quote that I'm going to read from you.
Oh, no.
Yeah. From the first interview, you said, "By the time I was 12, people started asking me what I was going to be when I grew up. Like any normal preteen, I had to rebel against everything my parents and family represented. So I would tell people, I'm going to be a lawyer or a doctor."
Yes, after the money, clearly.
Clearly. Who cares about creative satisfaction?
No, obviously not.
But, I mean, you're obviously creative from, I mean, everyone's creative as a child, but what forms of creativity were a part of your life when you were growing up?
I think the interesting thing is that it was so ingrained that I never really thought of it. And we're never really kind of pushed or pressured into pursuing a creative practice. So I think we were just kind of very subconsciously brainwashed, because my two younger sisters also found themselves in, the other one's a fashion designer and the other one's in music. I think it was more through but kind of very gentle encouragement. So my mom, whenever would come back from school, she'd have clean sheets of paper, and then she'd like sharpen our crayons, and then we would just come straight to the desk and then start drawing. And I think it was probably mostly stemmed from the fact that it was the only thing. We were terrible children and would fight a lot, so it was the only thing that would keep us quiet for a few hours at a time. So I think it was always kind of just instilled in a very subconscious way. And we'd walk around with my mom, and she'd stop all of us and she'd be like, "Look at that amazing green," and then we'd all stand there and stare at a wall. And as a child, you don't really get the point of it, but it does really bring this kind of way of looking at things and looking at color and being perceptive to those things. So eventually, it seems pretty natural that we more or less all gravitated towards that.
Yeah, so when it came time for you to go to university and choose a major, you actually did choose something creative. But initially, you wanted to be, and I quote you, the world's most famous movie director.
Of course. Of course. Still after the money, clearly.
Still the money and the fame. So you went to university and you were trying, I think, to go to an orientation or find out info. And then when you were there, you accidentally discovered this thing called graphic design. So tell us that story. It's a really fun one.
Yeah, it was crazy. So it was my third year of high school, and you know, you have to kind of start deciding where you're gonna apply after high school's done. And I was applying to a major in geography. It was just all over the place. But then movie directing, I had done really shitty kind of movie projects at school. They were really terrible. But somehow that gave me the self-confidence to be the best female movie director. It's kind of, now I kind of judge myself for saying best female. Obviously, I should have aimed for best altogether. But that's what I was going for. And then, they had this orientation tour at the university, and the girl who was giving the tour, I went to ask her questions because at university in Finland, everything is free, so they need to regulate how many people get in, and they have these entrance exams. And for example, for the movie department, it's two people, the movie directing department, two people out of 200 that get in. So I wanted to get my entrance exams right. So I went with a bunch of questions to her, and she was like, I can't really help you with that. I'm from graphic design. I was like, might as well ask about that since I showed up. And she started talking about it, and kind of like Natasha, but I had never really realized what graphic design was. But weirdly enough, it was something that I had always been doing. I was obsessed about making magazines. I had this magazine that was like run entirely by me. I was the editor in chief and the art director and photographer and only commissioned illustrator and editor of Friendy magazine, which mostly covered the Spice Girls and Seal Murder. My favorite man and my favorite animal. And all of this made sense. Like when I look at them now, I'm like, there's two columns. Like this is clearly very, like I was perceptive of it, never really understood. So yeah, kind of through that accident of her giving the tour, that's why I'm sitting here. Happy accident.
I had no idea that would be the connection between you two.
Accidents.
Graphic design, I think, is still a mystery to most people.
Yes.
You know, like it took my mom really several years to begin to get a grasp on that, because it's like I would show her, for example, a book that I designed, right? You know, hey, mom, you know, the first project I've realized, and this was, I think, 2008, like out of my internship. And she would say, oh, did you take the photo? No. did you actually do the illustrations in the book? No.
Did you make the paper?
Did you do the paper? No. So what did you do exactly? Right? Mom, I deal with typography. What is that? You know.
Parents. Okay, so Lotta, you went to the University of Art and Design, Helsinki, and then you did a semester abroad at RISD.
Yes.
And then you had a dream of moving to New York. So you finished school, worked in Finland for a while, right?
Yes, and at a fashion magazine. So editorial was still going strong. And I didn't get to cover Spice Girls and Seals, though, unfortunately.
You do that on your own time, right?
Yeah, obviously, still have a zine.
There's no budget for that. And then you made a decision to move to New York. So was that a big risk?
Yes and no. I feel my family is really scattered around. I mean, when I was 5, we moved to Paris from Helsinki, Finland. And when I was 10, we moved back. And currently my parents live in Portugal. One of my sisters lives in Paris, one of them in Berlin, and my grandma's in Finland. And I think because of this very apparently nomadic genes, I feel like it really changed the concept of home. Like it felt less of a place and more of a place that you kind of, less of a physical place and more of a place that you build around people that you love. So to me, never, I remember at my farewell party, I had a friend who was like, that's so courageous. Like, I don't know how you can leave your friends and everything behind. I was like, I wasn't really thinking of leaving anybody behind. I never thought that that would mean that you ditch your friends or your family, that you move. So in that sense, it didn't feel like a risk. And obviously with the added privilege of coming from a country where I could go easily back to if things just were to not work out. So that also obviously makes risk taking very not risky to a certain extent. And I don't get very easily embarrassed. I'm the kind of person I'll fall on my face and start laughing about it when other people look really upset. So I organized a very extravagant farewell party, all the while thinking that I might very well be back in 2 months, and then I'll just make a hilarious joke. So not risky.
But you're still here.
I'm still here, though. Yeah, 7.5 years.
Yeah. And so when you moved to New York, you actually interned at Pentagram.
Yes.
Also, which I also did not know before the research.
Did everyone Pentagram?
So no, rite of passage.
It's just, yeah. Yeah. So you interned at Pentagram, and then you went
in
on
Paula's team. Yeah.
Awesome.
Not over a candle at dinner, though. Mm.
I also interned for Paula. That was 2001. Yeah.
Good times, though. She made me cry once, though. I have to say, no. In a good way, though. I was working on something and she walked past and she was like, I don't like that. And then she walked away and I was really stressed out and really young and really nervous. And I went to the bathroom. I was like, I don't think I can handle New York.
No.
And then the next day she walked past my computer and she was like, ooh, I really like what you're doing. I was like, okay, I get
the gist. I totally know what you're talking about. Yeah.
And I really appreciated her for it. Like, honest feedback is the best feedback you can get, even if it makes you cry in the bathroom for a second at one point.
And then you come back and do it all over again.
Exactly. Yeah.
Just get back up.
Always.
So you interned at Pentagram, you cried, and then you were happy again.
I love this idea that this goes into a podcast.
I'm
a weeper.
Make sure Paula listens to it, Natasha.
Oh, okay. She will.
Send my regards.
You could send some flowers on the day
of course,
that it airs.
Yeah, I probably should after this if she listens to it, yeah.
So after interning at Pentagram, you went on to work for Roanne Adams at Roe & Co.
Yes.
And then you went out on your own to form your studio in 2012. So I guess, you know, what did you learn from working for someone else, and then, you know, what was the catalyst for you to go out on your own?
Yeah, I think it was working for myself was something I definitely had. I knew I was going to do eventually. I'm too much of an egomaniac to not have ended up working for myself at one point or the other. But I felt like when I, after the magazine in Finland, I felt like I still wasn't ready. Like, I felt like I had things that I didn't have an understanding or knowledge of that I still wanted to have of. And I really wanted to work more in visual identities, and therefore where I ended up working here was obviously an amazing school for that. I think it was the best decision ever to work for other people. With a few points, one obviously being able to watch how other people do it. Isn't the best schooling you can get. What they do similarly to what you could do, just as well as when you disagree with the people you work with, I think you learn just as much from that. And I think it's really important. And what it enabled me was that I had, through working full-time, I had the financial security of a full-time job. So the freelance jobs I was doing on the side, because I still had the stamina to pull all-nighters at the time, were really projects that I think were in the vein that I wanted to do more of. So over the years, I think on the side, I was able to build a portfolio of not personal work, but very low paid, like graphic design work, but that very much corresponded what I wanted to do more of. So when I went on my own, I just launched a portfolio full of that work, and it really helped me position myself to the work I wanted to have more of.
Yeah, that's great to have your full-time job paying the bills and then build a portfolio of the work that you want to do. And I think when I had interviewed you the first time, you were working at Roe & Co. And then it was like a couple of weeks went by and just before we published your interview, you emailed and said, "Hey, I quit my job. Can we update that in the interview?"
I know. I love the, yeah, the added
thing. We did an update at the end.
I think it said, the added bit at the end of the interview said, "You go, girl." And I was like, I was really like, did I fuck up? Should I have not quit? Can I do this on my own? And then it said, "You go, girl." And I was like, hell yeah, you go, girl.
I'm sure I wrote that, but gosh, it's kind of embarrassing that I wrote that. That's so cheesy.
That interview on my end is pretty embarrassing, so I'm glad we both made a fool of ourselves.
Maybe it will just disappear from the site mysteriously.
Mystery Silver Knight, yeah. Got hacked. Fake news.
Hacked by Russia. So how has your business grown over the last 5 years?
I mean...
Or I guess, what kinds of work are you focusing on?
It's interesting because I work between illustration and graphic design. And when I went on my own, it was pretty heavily illustration, mostly because I had an illustration agent and I just had much more contacts through that because I had done more freelance gigs as an illustrator, especially towards the end where it started feeling like when you pull a long full day of graphic design, when I started my second shift, like the night shift, it felt somehow more fresh to do illustration. So it didn't feel like Groundhog Day. So in the beginning, it was much more illustration and then started getting more and more graphic design. Currently, the situation is, I would want to say, 85% graphic design and much less illustration. So I've really put illustration a little bit on hold for now to focus more on graphic design, which had a lot to do with kind of hitting a slight dead end with illustration. And I feel like I kind of painted myself into a corner, digitally painted myself into a corner. And it felt like it started repeating itself. So the good thing about having one foot in two professions was that I was able to kind of then revert to graphic design and focus on that while I figure out what the hell I'm going to do with illustration.
I asked Natasha this, and I want to ask you as well. What do you wish you had known before you went and started your own business?
What would I have wanted to know? I think I would have wanted in the beginning, that was something I only started doing 2-3 years in, but talking more to my peers about what they charge. That was kind of a really big thing for me, because I think money tends to be, we're briefly discussing this earlier, but money tends to be something that people aren't that eager to talk about, or they might be if you ask them, but most people just find it very rude to even ask to begin with. So that was something that really changed it for me, to discuss with other people working in the field what they were charging, and especially when talking to male peers who I really respected, but realized that I was charging half less than they were. So that was definitely something I wish I maybe would have done sooner. But then again, maybe the work wouldn't have been at that level yet. But definitely, yeah, talking more to other people about their practices.
Yeah, that's great advice. So we've been talking about this theme of accidents, and both of you kind of accidentally stumbled into design.
I'm just waiting till we say we're both accidents.
No, I would never say that. Never. You accidentally discovered illustration. And I think that, you know, it's so I've interviewed nearly 250 people for The Great Discontent, and there's this theme that pops up over and over that none of us know what the hell we're doing. And at the time, you know, there's doubt and fear, and we second guess ourselves. Looking back, it's so easy to look at both of your paths and say, oh, they planned it all out, right? Like, you can connect the dots. But in the moment, it doesn't feel like that. And so I know we get a lot of emails of, you know, people asking for advice because they're at the beginning of their career and they're trying to figure out, you know, they're trying to line everything up. And that's hard to do on the front side. It's easy to do looking back. So I'm sure you guys both get a lot of emails and talk to students. What advice would each of you give to someone who is at the beginning of their path and trying to figure it out?
Do you want to go first?
Who wants to go first, or should I pick?
I can start, and then you get the next one first. Sure. Maybe it'll be a harder one.
Oh, no, you both get to answer this.
now I lost my train of thought. Advice
to someone starting out who feels like they have to have it all figured out up front.
I can't believe I called myself out because I was actually going to answer that. I think giving advice to other people is extremely hard. And the way I've kind of figured it out is that I feel like I've always been really driven and really motivated and worked a lot, but I've never had any set goals for myself. And maybe that would be, I don't know if it works for everybody, but for me to a certain extent, it helps you have good accidents to a certain extent. So not planning out a trajectory too clearly. I don't think I would have moved to New York if I had kind of planned myself a path, for example, in Finland, and decided this is what I'm working towards. And you kind of put this blindfold of almost of seeing any other opportunities that might pop along the way. So yeah, don't plan it out is my advice. What good advice?
Natasha?
Well, I think planning, like especially life planning, career planning, long-term planning never really works because, you know, life is unplanned, I think, by nature. But I think that try to look at yourself not only through a practical lens, which we all do all the time, meaning, you know, what is the best job for me out there? What would be the first thing that I do after school or, you know, after this job? So we tend to look at ourselves through these very practical lenses, which is what we do. But I think that trying to kind of think of yourself in a kind of idealized vacuum, meaning that you gotta dream a little bit, you know, even it's like daydream, I think is extremely helpful because by doing that, it kind of pulls you out of the typical mode of the rhythm, you know, of the day-to-day kind of thing. And you can begin to kind of, you know, think about yourself and think about what is surrounding you a little bit more differently. The other thing also, which is something that I'm still trying to do as much as I can, is to surround myself with people who are smarter than me and who are better than me in different ways. I think that it is really the best kind of experience you can have because, you know, you get inspired by these people and you learn from them and you get better too. So these would be the two things that I would advise.
That was really great. Thank you.
That's really good.
You're welcome.
I want to shift gears a little bit. I want to talk about Natasha's favorite subject, which is design thinking. Here we go. You knew I was going to go there. So you gave a talk at 99U conference this past spring. And the title of your talk, Design Thinking is Bullshit.
Uh-huh.
She's nodding.
Okay, bring it on.
So, I'm not a designer, so I'm not going to argue this with you. I think it's bullshit because I don't get it. But... So one of your critiques is that, you know, design thinking is often used in scenarios where you really don't need this five-step process. It's common sense and it's intuition. And one of the examples you gave was this MRI scan for children that they made it less intimidating by painting it as a scene and doing a mural on the wall. Like, that's common sense. We don't need design thinking to tell us that, right? So I think, you know, part of this is about putting our faith and trust in a process versus trusting our intuition and experience. And so the question, and I want to ask both of you this, is how do you balance between trusting in a process, which feels very safe, you know, like the theory and the steps that you go through, versus trusting your own voice and intuition? And, you know, I think when we're starting out, it's so easy to doubt our own voice, or we feel like we don't have a voice or perspective, and even if we intuit something, we don't always act on it because we're like, no, that's wrong. I don't know what I'm doing yet. I haven't been doing this long enough. So, how do you find that balance?
Do you want to go?
You go.
I operate more intuitively, but yet I find myself a pretty methodical person. So it's a kind of interesting situation where I trust my guts for the most part. And when I actually don't, things tend to go wrong. And again, this is a conclusion through years of learning, you know, especially in recent years, I begin to notice that when I actually don't trust my gut reaction, I tend to make wrong decisions. But then at the same time, you do need certain methodologies to do things more effectively, right? And I think methodology is really about optimizing certain things, about achieving results, about achieving success, you know, so on and so forth. But I think that if that actually becomes the end goal in itself, that is wrong, because I think that is really what you're trying to achieve for certain objectives that you have. Be an artistic objective, or be something that is meaningless, for example. But the process itself should never replace the thing that you're trying to do. And that is sort of my issue with the current state of design thinking. First of all, design thinking as a thought, as a way of training, it has a really, you know, deep academic root, you know, starting out in Stanford. So design thinking by itself and of itself is nothing wrong. But I think it's the way that now people begin to think of it as a commodity that you can just acquire. You can go through a boot camp, for example, in a matter of 3 days, you would get certified. So it is really that aspect that I think is really wrong. You know, so you're basically acquiring a process and thinking that process itself equates design. So I try to, you know, always encourage my designers to trust their intuition. But then, you know, we have to work very methodically and analytically too.
Yeah, and I think the methods also come through working on projects through intuition
through
and
experiences,
looking at them.
Exactly.
So I feel like every previous project informs the next. But I definitely agree. I definitely, the best results I get are through intuition. I mean, same applies to even in acquiring clients. When you are in the good place where you get to pick who to work with, I think the gut feeling of who you should work with and who's going to be on the same wavelength is typically, with a few exceptions, but typically right. And yeah, obviously same yeah. applies to design. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But why do we ignore that intuition, right?
Sometimes it feels frivolous, at least to me. Intuition, for example, when you present work, I think intuition to a certain extent, it would be hard for me to walk into trying to present a visual identity and saying, I just felt that this was good. And the client's like, what do I care that what you felt? And then I usually try to rationalize the process like in post, which is really interesting, which is that you have done these things with intuition and then you just need to put it down in words.
Yeah, and I also think that, you know, the fact that I think that as a society or as a generation, we're pretty fragile at the moment, you know, which has to do with the kind of social political climate out there, you know, and also with the digital culture where everything, information is so saturated, where you're exposed to this overwhelming amount of images and information, news all the time, right? But I also think that there is a kind of a self-help culture that I think tends to make people feel a lot more insecure and doubtful about themselves. So, I mean, that's how, you know, a lot of self-help tends to generate business, right? And I think there has always been self-help, you know, that itself is a huge industry. But I think that in today's culture, you actually get to be exposed to a lot of that, a lot more, you know, even in kind of very implicit way, not necessarily through ads and all that. And I think all these kind of affect our psyche a little bit to a certain degree. And again, the education system, I think globally, is not kind of designed to train how to exercise intuition. I think that intuition, trusting your own intuition, is very much like a muscle that you have to do a lot of exercise in order to get good at it and begin to actually feel it that, oh, I actually have this muscle. But, you know, our education system doesn't have that at all. And that itself, I think, is a very interesting thing to talk about. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I like that analogy of it's a muscle that you have to use. And I mean, sometimes your intuition may be wrong, right? So it's having that space to fail and be okay and just try again next time.
Yeah, not getting upset about, your intuition. Yeah, that's the thing, that it's easy to get discouraged by intuition, because also part of the time it guides you through terrible paths.
Yes. So I want to reference... That's all I need to say about that. Yes. I agree wholeheartedly.
Dot.
Yes, period. So I want to talk about one other thing that you touched on, Natasha, in your 99U talk about design thinking being bullshit. And you talked about, well, actually, you asked this question, why don't we want to get messy? And I loved that because life is messy. And I think, you know, part of it is letting go of this idea of perfection. And I want to read a quote from one of my favorite authors, and then I'll ask you guys something. It's kind of a long quote, so hang with me, but it's really good. It is Anne Lamott, and it's from a book called Bird by Bird, Some Instructions on Writing and Life. And it's a really great book. If you haven't read it, I highly recommend it. She says, "Perfectionism is the voice of the oppressor, the enemy of the people. It will keep you cramped and insane your whole life. And it is the main obstacle between you and a shitty first draft. I think perfectionism is based on the obsessive belief that if you can run carefully enough, hitting each stepping stone just right, you won't have to die. The truth is that you will die anyway, and that a lot of people who aren't even looking at their feet are going to do a whole lot better than you, and have a lot more fun while they're doing it." So what I want to ask is, how can we let go of these, you know, the rigid process and the perfectionism, and really embrace the messiness of our work? Is that something that you've been able to do? Is it an ongoing challenge? How do we do that?
I personally can't give a real answer to that, because I get really, it's a trait I've had since forever. I was put to play the violin when I was three or four. I probably learned to walk. Four, I started playing the violin. And it was going pretty well for the first few weeks until my parents took me to see a professional violinist at a concert, after which I refused to touch the violin because he was so much better than I was after playing 2 weeks at 4 years old. So this only to illustrate what my starting point is. So this is a constant battle I have with myself, where I feel like I have a tendency to polish things too much and get really hung up on perfection. It's something I really strive to do, and something that recently has really helped me with getting more raw, for example, with the way I work in illustration, was putting it aside. And once I put it aside and I only worked on two projects in the last year, I noticed slowly that I started gravitating against my notebook again. And I hadn't done any hand drawing in years, like only mandatory sketches, but not. I had kind of lost kind of a will to draw. And once I put it aside, this thing that had become in a way too much about execution and not about discovery, I kind of discovered discovery through like the pleasure of making by hand again. So these are little things that I'm trying to do. This is a very literal interpretation of messy, but considering that I worked with such clean vector-based illustrations, getting to these imperfect sketches and finding this pleasure of seeing and drawing instantly, I think has been of help. And now I'm trying to figure out ways of how to apply it to graphic design as well, which is a process.
I love that. Natasha?
We kind of think about perfectionism a little differently, you know. First of all, perfection doesn't really exist in my vocabulary, because I think for me, like, if I think about perfection, that itself doesn't have a destination to it. You know what I mean? It's not here or there. But when you're looking at things in context, comparatively, contextually, then you will find the destination and the direction that you have to go, right? And that's sort of how we think about the projects that we do. I think that in the design business, you will have two types of, I would say, you know, products, you know, be perfect or be messy. One is the ideas. You can have really, really messy ideas. They're basically not workable. You can have ideas that seem messy on the surface, but in fact, there are a lot of good, you know, original thinking behind that. And then ideas are harder to actually better, but formal imperfections or formal flaws, meaning that is it, you know, the outline of this shape, formal perfections are easy to work with, just because they're tangible, you know. They're like making a sculpture that you can actually push things in a certain way. But I always find coming up with actually valuable and exciting ideas are a lot harder, you know, and in that context, perfection doesn't exist at all. This is all about what is actually good, you know, what is actually something that's really, really great for the situation that we're in.
And sometimes I definitely agree with that. And I think sometimes also, yeah, mine was also a very figurative example of it. But to me, to me, visuals are also sometimes like a good key to unlock kind of the idea-based thinking of,
yeah, definitely,
of thinking in a freer, more or less kind of ready way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. Visual stimulates thoughts, you know, stimulates ideas. And sometimes certain ideas actually come from seeing certain things. It's kind of free association, yeah. And that part is really important in the creative process.
Yeah, that's awesome. Thank you. So I have one last question. And so one of the things that we like to ask a lot about at The Great Discontent, you know, is about this idea of creative satisfaction. Are you satisfied? Do you want to be? Will you ever be? And so creative satisfaction is like, it's really about this body of work that we're creating and that we'll one day leave behind as our legacy or something. That's very large, right? But I want to quote you again, Lata, because I've interviewed you so many times.
I've answered this question twice.
I'm not going to ask you this again. Just wait.
Oh, I wish I could have answered it a third time.
I mean, if you want to answer it again, I might let you. But
I'll let you quote.
So I'm going to quote you how you answered it in 2012. If you want to update, you can. Just stop cringing. It's going to be okay. You said, "I've come to realize that the things I want have more to do with the quality of life rather than work goals. I want to have time for myself and enjoy life. I feel so lucky to have found this thing I love, but I still don't want it to be my everything." So before I ask the question, do you still stand by that?
I do. I think it's kind of a simplified maybe way of how I see it now. And you know, the question of work-life balance often comes up. And I have a hard time sometimes wrapping my head around work-life balance, because obviously being lucky enough to be doing something that I wouldn't know how to do in a way. Anything else at this point, maybe in the future, but that, yeah. So I think when you find something that you, yeah.
That, I get it.
Yeah. We just, yeah.
No, it's so what I've been thinking about in this vein is, you know, this idea of creative satisfaction and legacy. But I think, you know, that question is so far off into the future. And what I've been thinking about more recently, just in my own life and work, is, you know, maybe the question is more about the here and now. And maybe it's more about, you know, presently, what do I find fulfilling in my work and personal life? And so instead of asking you about legacy or are you creatively satisfied or will you be one day in the future, my last question for you is, in the present, in this current moment in your lives, what do you want more of that would make your work and or personal life more fulfilling?
Well, first of all, I'm pretty satisfied with what I have right now, you know, as a creative person, also just as a person. I think I'm really lucky in many ways. And looking back in the last, you know, 10 years or so, I think I was also very lucky throughout the path, because I was creatively satisfied with whatever that I was doing at that time. But now, looking back as Natasha now, and looking at the things that I was doing back then, I would ask myself, how could I have been satisfied with that? You know, for example, like I really enjoyed designing, say, posters and books, you know, and that was really like the thing that I just wanted to do in 2002 when I graduated. I still enjoy doing those, but I know that I wouldn't be 100% satisfied if that was the only thing that I was doing. So I think that creative satisfaction really matures and changes with you, you know, at different stages of life. And you may find yourself just all of a sudden lose interest in something that you were really passionate about. And I think that is totally okay. And just, you know, embark on whatever new that actually comes your way, and, you know, let that, you know, mature with you.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I've answered it in a few different ways. I think the first one, I was extremely satisfied. And the second interview, I laughed at my previous answer. And now I feel like it's really something, it's coming to terms that those two things coexist. Because I've realized enough of those little touch points of satisfaction to kind of have this feeling that I want to keep doing this, and that I have enough confidence that I'm good at what I do. And that comes from that, those little moments, even momentary nuggets, even if you're not later satisfied with it, even for a second when you send something out or present something and you're like, this is fantastic. And then you might hate it mm-hmm. the next day or in a week or in a year. But I think those nuggets are important to keep that kind of just that motivation and just excitement up. And at the same time, I feel being too content, obviously, I feel like you then resort to more patterns. So the dissatisfaction, I think, is really important to feed into that hunger of wanting to do different things differently, better. I think that's really important for those two things to coexist.
Agree.
Well, I'm completely satisfied, and those are all the questions I have. Natasha, Jen, and Lata Nieminen, everyone. Thank you.
Thank you.
This episode was produced by The Great Discontent and me, Benjamin Welch. The Great Discontent features in-depth conversations with today's artists, makers, and risk-takers. You can learn more at thegreatdiscontent.com. And of course, you can subscribe to this show on iTunes or wherever you find your podcasts. And if you enjoyed this episode, please consider giving us a rating in iTunes. It really does help spread the word. Thanks so much for listening.